look, this was my question. You know, it is not necessarily in my disposition to go hard on Rawls. I'm going to be real. Like, in my day-to-day work, Rawls isn't very important to me. I hear people talk about them, but I'm just like, okay. But I want to focus on James Boggs or something like that. But straight up, he talks about this, you know, public culture, and an aspect of the argument that we haven't talked much about is, you know, he wants to say, he wants to make an argument this will be stable. He even briefly in the lecture that you had us read on, he wants to say how something like the overlapping consensus could conceivably come about, because he wants to show that this isn't utopian in the pejorative sense. But one key fact, and this is absolutely important to Rawls, as far as I can tell, is the citizens have to have a sense of justice. Mm-hmm. And what I understand by this sense of justice is, you know, not only that they trust these institutions, but they have a disposition towards, you know, this notion of justice that would be the outcome. But with this focus on the democratic culture, the easy critique is something like Rawls never considered X injustice. Okay, bracket that out. But we still have to ask, well, what if we live in a basically unjust society? What if our culture, what is even implicit in it, has distorted our sense of justice? And so the question I'd want to ask, and yeah, Rawls talks about slavery and even uses the Reconstruction Amendments to show that something like this is possible. And yet one might ask, well, if we live in a society in which our basic structure is fundamentally unjust, why should we think that the reflective equilibrium will work? I'm sure Rawlsians have answers to it, but I don't find it very convincing to think that, well, it just is if you commit to the process. So it seems to me that Rawls must be looking at the United States. He does not think that its basic structure is fundamentally broken. He thinks that there are injustices, but there are the, you know, the implicit norms and ideals that can allow us to understand what a reasonable society would look like. And I think the question is, and he chalks this up to a type of moral psychology, if he thinks that a just society will be stable because, you know, citizens will become habituated to it, they will become the type of people who develop a sense of justice, the argument runs in the other direction, that in an unjust society, citizens will become habituated to a sense of injustice. Mm-hmm. And so what I find myself struggling with is, I don't really feel like I get an answer of how one transitions from those who have been habituated to a sense of injustice to a sense of justice, and how that's supposed to work. So I'm like, why should we trust our democratic
culture? I just want to clarify really quick the question. Is part of your question also that, like, in some societies, maybe even in the United States, if you reach down into that fund of, like, implicit ideas in the public culture, you find something actually quite dark? Like, why is it guaranteed that when you reach
down? Or at least it's not quite clear to me that what you find is always going to be something that helps with
this.
History is messy and all of that. And I'd like to hear y'all's response to that. I don't understand why I should trust that the democratic culture of the United States can do this work that he's describing, especially when he says it's stable because when citizens develop a sense of justice, then that is what they pass on through generations. Why wouldn't the other thing pass on through generations? And so it's a question of transition.
I think he would just concede that if you can make the argument that's true, that you're right about that. Like, I think the problem with, like, I'm just going to kind of insist that the problem with Rawls is that the nature of the theory itself, the method of it, It's hard to nail down what the problem with the method is. So if he's saying that the kinds of things you're talking about, that, and of course, an unjust basic structure would generate an unjust ethos in the culture, Rawls would say, yes, that's what I'm saying.
I get that he'd grant that, but yeah, I don't know.
And if part of the problem is that he doesn't see the basic structure he lives in as is fundamentally unjust, then a Rawlsian or Rawls himself could just say, okay, well, then that's a correction of a matter of fact in a way. Like, that's an argument about the nature of things. That's not about an argument about the way I think they should be. So if I'm wrong to think that the U.S. has a just basic structure, then I'm wrong about that. That's in a way, the way that he brackets the methodological argument is its strongest point. And I suppose that one of the real challenges I have in reading Rawls is that I often find that, at least to me, the criticisms that it's kind of like he doesn't get the nature of things as they are. I feel
that's not what I'm saying, though. But I get that.
I thought what I interpreted what you're saying is that there is an implicit argument in his account that there is a basic structure in the U.S. Is that not what you're saying?
What I was trying to say is something like, if it isn't simply about the facts of the case, you know, what work is the democratic culture doing for him in this argument? Because that's what makes it stable. So it seems to me he doesn't want to just say this is what a just society would look like. He even wants to try to give an argument of how we could come to have a just society. So this isn't, you know, ideal theory in the worst sense like, you know, just like inventing an idea in my head of this is what things should look like. But he also wants to say that there's something practical to this, that this is not unrealistic. That's what I thought was going on in lecture four, when he's kind of pushing back against people thinking, oh, but we could never come to an overlapping consensus. And he wants to show, I can give you a story of how we could get there.
So I guess my reply to that is that the reason I think the methodological point is strong is not because I find it particularly like realistic, but my question is always is like, what is the counter argument? So like the political left historically has banked a lot on the fact that people can change, that when you create better constraints for them, better incentives, you can make them adapt for the better and not for the worse. Mm-hmm. If that's not true, like anthropologically, or we're just so fucked up that it's not possible for it to ever be true, I think there's a lot more at stake than just Rawls. I think that there's a lot more at stake that's bigger than that. And I think that Rawls's gamble that that is true, I think that's a gamble that has pretty high stakes. Because if you were to fill in the transition question, how are we going to move us? Like, how are you going to turn the modus vivendi into a cooperative society? Any political program is going to face this problem. And if you think there's a fundamental lack of possibility of conversion, basically, because it's so rotten or so bad, or it's just not a practical anthropological claim about how human beings are, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's right. Hey. That's definitely right. No, but I think that like the force of Will's question is like, so here's another quote. This is from page 26. On the veil, in justifying the veil of ignorance and responding to, again, objections like these, which he's very good at anticipating, what is it that we expect the veil of ignorance to be able to do for us and why? And he says, well, no, it's just a device of representation, right? It's helping us figure out our own ideas. It's not, of course, that we can, in fact, like do this empirically, et cetera, and so forth. He says, what it does is help us work out what we now think once we are able to take a clear and uncluttered view of what justice requires when society is conceived as a scheme of cooperation between free and equal citizens from one generation to the next. And that's helpful, but it also has my problem embedded within it, right? What we now think might not be, maybe I'm being, by the way, maybe I'm being like a fucking Platonist here or something, right? I'm like, you know, I'm trying to argue against that sort of attempt at figuring out like what a historically now situated conception of justice would be, like against what, like an ideal of justice to which I don't have empirical access. Like I get that I'm starting to sound a little wacky on this, but I do think there's a method problem here that's different from the one that, yeah, I'm not sure. Cause I also like what you're saying, Lillian. I don't totally disagree. I don't think though that I'm entirely sold on, let me put it like this. I think that there might be too much built into that word reasonable. That sounds to me like a comprehensive doctrine. And he insists that it's not. Right? Because like the veil of ignorance is supposed to be like, strip aside all of your comprehensive doctrines. What are we left with? But what are we left with is like what a reasonable person would think. And I'm like, I don't know, that does feel, he says, I'm not, you know, presupposing a metaphysical conception of the person or the human being. But I don't know, there's still something there that I'm left a little bit unsure about. Like, it seems like there's still like rational choice procedures or like a particular need for a conception of a certain kind of justice in light of a concept of society as a well-ordered cooperative effort. I'm like, that's a lot, actually. I'm not sure that that's not part of like a more fundamental comprehensive doctrine that we could call liberalism, right? Why is liberalism not a comprehensive doctrine?
He actually has a long footnote that he kind of like backs up and says, well, you know, it depends on what you mean by metaphysical. And so he actually seems to grant that depending on how you take metaphysics, it could be a metaphysics of the person.
I think the invocation of Plato is right, though, Gil. Like he seems to want to avoid a kind of trans-historical essence of justice or something that isn't worked out in any situated way. Then also avoid the kind of Thrasymachus argument that justice is just the right of the stronger. It doesn't actually have any kind of like normative content. So like, how do you get historically situated normative content that isn't just reducible to the social arrangements and power positions of like a given, of a given society?
Of the existent,
I have my other problem though with the transition question that you brought up, Lillian, is like how he conceives of that happening, like the process through which these kind of transition or mutability of people and their dispositions might, his argument for the mutability of those dispositions. Because he says that one of the points of the abstraction of the original position and the veil of ignorance, the point of the abstraction is to enable public discussion. You can't just have people coming at each other with comprehensive doctrines because they're, you face this incommensurability problem where like, it's not that they actually disagree about X, Y, or Z. They just disagree on the meaning of X, Y, or Z. So they can't even like, you know, you can't even work it out. So the idea though, that it's the public discussion, that's the kind of pragmatic, that's the pragmatic element of what he's saying here. Like this is all to facilitate this thing called public discussion. And so there's moments like that where, and again, I don't think it's possible to pull the rug out from Rawls. I think you have to do like a lot of work to land like a jab against him. But I still just feel tempted sometimes to say the points where it makes me bristle, right? And so the idea that, okay, we're going to abstract away from historical contingencies, social positionality, and all that, and that's going to facilitate this thing called like public discussion that will help us arrive or whatever. And it's difficult for me to imagine how public discussion gets our way out of like political impasses, like big political impasses, like climate, like exploitation, extrajudicial executions. I mean, the public discussion thing, I don't know. That's the part of the transition that I buy the transition is possible. I do believe you're right to point out how important this is as an idea for the left and for the mutability of people's dispositions. I just don't know that like public discussions is how.
So I'll say that like my criticism of this is that I think that basically there are elements of Rawlsian liberalism that I think are desirable. And I think it's not possible to pull the rug out from under him by like, I mean, so I'll just say, here's some of the things I think are the most frustrating critiques, like the critique of individualism, the critique of like, that he denies politics, the kind of agonistic critique and so on. I just don't think it's sympathetic because he's actually saying something like, I can imagine asking some of these same questions under socialism. How are you going to tolerate each other if some of the deep antagonisms are gone? Because it doesn't mean that there's going to be an absence of conflict. Okay, so there's a need to think about justice. So I some of these things that those more like de rigueur critiques that kind of emerged in the 90s and the aughts, I just don't find them that compelling. What I do find compelling is that, and I think this is about the transition question, that the theory has a status quo bias if you think in its terms in your ability to reflect on politics. So like, it has a kind of juridical bias. So like, if you've ever read his stuff on civil obedience, I think this is the weirdest and weakest part of Rawls, where like, you know, because, and I think this is to your point, Will, where like, I do think he infers that the constitutional structure in the US is basically just, and then you can see it in his own thinking, it's a status quo bias, because he thinks the legitimacy of the law is in fact the product of this reasonableness, you know, and therefore when people are breaking the law, he doesn't know what to do about that. So that's why people have this like, you know, non-ideal theory distinction. And then he does ideal theory, we do non-ideal theory. I find this to be like kind of mind-boggling because in a way it still has a status quo bias because it just means that basically the assumptions that are made about how to reflect on reality remain, except for that now you're just granting there's all this injustice in the world and you see it as such. But the transition problem doesn't go away. So like to me, it's more like the method, like in asserting what it wants to assert, is actually comes up with some desirable outcomes. And indeed, people were able to like push Rawls to the left over his career. I think that's actually kind of an incredible thing. But in its reflections on politics, in the way that it thinks about the justifications for political actions, it is actually an extremely conservative perspective. And and I don't know how to reconcile these things, because I really do believe that. I think it's a very conservative perspective. I also think, for what it's worth, that non-ideal theory is a very conservative perspective. It's like, okay, now we're just going to conceptualize all the injustices that exist, and then we're going to think about them in terms with and as a correction of. There's something that has never sat right with me about that. And what's missing, and I'm sorry, I know I'm lecturing guys, but what's missing to me is the things the left always said were missing, which are an understanding of history, an understanding of normative expectations as they are, an understanding of how social change shapes those, and the fact that, like, they need to continue to be articulated over time, you know, and, you know, enter Habermas or whoever. But, you know, I don't really like that either.
Yeah, I like that. So I want to be clear, because I'm worried, like, some people might take away from this that I don't think that people can change. I do think that people can change. I think explaining.
Not me, pal.
Fair enough. Gills are determined. We, you know, we got the Spinozan in the chat. And
no, no. That's no. Determinists can allow that people can change. I'm saying I can't change.
Okay, fair enough. All right, it's Gills speaking his own voice.
Hey, thanks so much for listening. This was just a small sample of the full episode. To listen to it and to access other premium content we're putting out, including all of our locked episodes and bonus videos, please subscribe to us on Patreon at patreon.com/leftofphilosophy. See you next time.